it for the show today. Just going to play one last song. And stay tuned for Warning Shots. This is The Men off of their album, Open Your Heart. This is, song is called Open Your Heart.
There are no mirrors. Yes, hello and welcome. You are tuned into Warning Shots here on CKUW 95.9 FM. Warning Shots is CKUW's independent international news show, and I'm your host, Scott Price. And of course, CKUW 95.9 FM is your listener-driven radio station on the FM dial in Winnipeg. Today is March the 8th, and also a big happy International Women's Day to everyone out there, but more specifically to all the women out there. So hopefully, a lot of different traditions, International Women's Day. I believe there is a march happening today in Winnipeg, and a couple other things. I know one tradition I heard of is where at some workspaces, like I think that what they would do sometimes at the Mondragon is the women's staff would have the day off with pay and the men would have to do all the cooking and all that kind of stuff and all the behind-the-scenes stuff, where the women could just sit around, relax, and drink beer, or whatever, what have you. So, yeah, I don't know. But there's all sorts of different ways of celebrating it. But, yeah, happy International Women's Day nonetheless. Now, for today's show, we're going to hear an interview I did with John Shurto just this morning. He is the editor, manager, creator of Intercontinental Cry, which is an online news source on Indigenous struggles around the world. And, you know, I've had John on, I think we started in the fall, where he would come on about once a month to give you, the listener, an update on some of the Indigenous struggles that are happening. So I think it's really great that John has always given his time to do that and his in analysis and information, you know, because if you go on intercontinentalcry.org, I think it's really a good, what a testimony to John's work when you look at that website and you realize it's really him behind a lot of that. I mean, he has volunteers and people, other writers, but it's all sort of him, and it's really impressive. And it really shows you what independent media can do and what media can be, where, you know, you want the information, the straight up facts, as it were, about this kind of stuff, and as well as analysis. But nonetheless, you know, a great database of information for you to kind of wade in on rather than, you know, infotainment. I mean, and I think that's kind of a problem. And I think, you know, obviously with you listening right now on CKW, you're also, you know, making this choice of listening and supporting us. You, the listener, is very aware of this. but there is sort of this infotainment sort of thing. And, you know, I mean, I don't mean to totally bash other news sources or anything like that, but it certainly gets to that point. And where things get a bit more on the side of the vapid and the shallow rather than something that's more based on facts and facts and analysis and, you know, sort of like, well, this is what's happening. So Intercontinental Cry is a great example of that kind of work, as well as, you know, other great examples around Canada, but I think it's really great. And, you know, John is based out of Winnipeg, you know, so when you go and you look at Intercontinental Cry and what he's built up, he's based out of Winnipeg and he does it all independently. So it shows you what is possible. Not saying it's easy, but it's certainly something that's possible. So, but nonetheless, John will be on to discuss a couple different things going on, some stuff going on in Mexico, in Western Australia, as well as a very interesting cultural exchange between the Maori, who are indigenous people in New Zealand, some of the indigenous, Polynesian peoples in New Zealand, and the Ainu, who are actually an indigenous group in Japan, very interestingly. So there's a cultural exchange that has been set up. So John will also be talking about those things. So do stay tuned for that. So all that's coming up, and of course, also your international news and brief, but a couple of just quick announcements before we get into the whole part of the show. Now, as always, I'd like to always remind people that there are many locally produced spoken word shows that cover current events in an engaging and in-depth manner on CKUW 95.9 FM. There's People of Interest, Mud and Water, Inner City Voices, Black Mask, Say It Sista, and the Global Research News Hour. So for all the for all that information, check out the broadcast schedule for showtimes and for free show archives at CKUW.ca. So that's a service that we give to you, our listeners and supporters, as a way of kind of giving back, that if you can't listen to it live, you can always get the shows at the as a podcast on CKUW.ca. There's also our news blog, CKUWnews.ca. I try to upload stuff from People of Interest and from Warning Shots, but so check that. There's also older featured articles and interviews, interviews and audio that you can kind of check and see sort of what we're all about. Now, also, as I said at the top of the new show, CKW is a listener-driven media source, so we take listener-driven very seriously here. That means that not only are you supporting us by listening right now, but we also rely on your donations every February during Fund Drive. So, you know, for listener-driven, we really believe in that. And CKW is actually probably one of the only station here in, well, other than, I guess, UMFM, where you can, during the show, you can actually get a direct line to the show host. You know, like other stations, you can phone in, but there's a filter there. You can have direct contact with me. You know, sometimes it's a good thing, sometimes it's a bad thing, but it's part of what we do here. But I think it's mostly it's a great thing. So call 204-774-6877 during the show. Questions, comments, concerns. I always love hearing that from listeners. You know, it's why I do this is to create conversation and discussion. So I really encourage that. I also love to hear questions and comments via email. warningshots.ckuw959@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter at warningshots. I also encourage you to follow CKUW on Twitter at CKUW to find out all the great things that are happening at this wonderful little station that you are listening to right now. So now let's go into some of the news that's happening around the world right now. Now, here is your international news in brief. Weekly news update on the Americas reports judges in Cordoba City, the capital of the central Argentinian province of Cordoba, issued an order on February the 25th suspending construction of a corn seed drying plant by the Missouri-based biotech giant Monsanto. The provincial labor court judge, Sylvia Diaz and Luis Ferraz, cited potential environmental risks as the basis for the suspension, which was in response to an appeal by the Argentinian Law Foundation Club. The company plans to build a 27-hectare facility at the cost of $300 million in Argentina, in Malavas, a working-class suburb located 14 kilometers from the provincial capital. Malavas, Argentina's residents there are demanding a referendum on the planned construction and have held protest marches, including one on the 21st of February. And also from weekly news update on the Americas, a fire swept through a camp for survivors of Haiti's January 2012 earthquake in Port-au-Prince's eastern neighborhood in the night of the February the 16th, destroying tents and leaving 4,000 people without shelter. The inhabitants of the camp were among as many as 350,000 people in southern Haiti who still haven't obtained permanent shelter in the 3 years since their homes were destroyed or damaged by the quake. In a press release, the force for a reflection and action on housing and grassroots housing coalition said a 5-year-old was killed in the fire, which the group blamed on bandits who have also killed a young camp residents. during the day on February the 16th. So that is just a very brief look at a couple things happening around the world. We will be going to, in a moment, just a quick break, and then you'll hear from John Ashurto from Intercontinental Cry. And this is Warning Shots, and we'll be right back. So you'll want to stay tuned. Keep it locked here, CKW 95.9 FM.
Time for a CETA myth-busting fact from the Council of Canadians.
Harper's myth: CETA would not prevent Canada's municipal governments from sourcing goods and services locally.
CETA fact: the procurement rules in CETA will prohibit any covered government or public agency from preferring one bidding firm over another based on the amount of Canadian or local content in the goods or services being offered.
Call your MLA. Go to Canadians.org for more information.
It's so simple.
And we are back. This is Warning Shots on CKW 95.9 FM. Warning Shots is CKW's independent international news show. I'm your host, Scott Price. Now our main segment of the show. Here's an interview I just did this morning with John Ashurto, manager, creator, editor of Intercontinental Cry, which covers indigenous struggles around the world. So here is John talking about, giving us an update on struggles that are happening in Mexico and Australia, as well a cultural exchange between two indigenous groups. So without further ado, here is John Ashurto.
Let's begin with some of these things that are happening in Mexico. So in January, from what I gather from what I was reading, is that there's an indigenous group that has been camping outside government offices for a while, and then they were kind of kicked out, and there's this thing kind of going back and forth. So explain what the situation is in Mexico and who these indigenous people are there.
Okay. Well, these are the Triqui people. The situation there is actually pretty complex and at times extremely vicious. I'll start at the beginning of the current struggle. After the big popular uprising in Oaxaca in 2006, the Triqui people of San Juan Coppola decided to establish a new government based on their own customs and traditions. After doing so, they established an election process, and they brought in their new leaders. And so after they established themselves strongly, they declared themselves autonomous from the Oaxaca government. And they also went on to declare themselves adherents to the Zapatistas' other campaign. From that point on, the Triqui became targets of constant paramilitary violence, including rape, verbal abuse, kidnapping, and murder. This went on for 3 years. They declared independence in January 2007. In February 2010, a paramilitary group known as the Union for the Social Well-Being of the Triqui Region, which I believe was established to prevent the Zapatista other campaign from spreading in Oaxaca, decided to set up a military blockade around the town, the municipality of San Juan Coppola, which effectively cut off the Triqui's access to food, water, electricity, and medical supplies. A reporter and friend, Kristen Bricker, reported in September 2010 that the people of San Juan Coppola survived off a little food that the women could carry into town on their backs, using trails that they would through the woods that they would use to sneak past the gunmen who were on constant patrol. Several international caravans were organized to bring supplies to the Jigwe people, but they too faced the wrath of the paramilitary groups. The first caravan actually came under fire. I don't think the other ones did, but the first one did, which resulted in the death of two human rights observers. From there, the situation just continued to get worse. In 2010, actually, an important detail to note here is that the paramilitary group was a supporter of the PRI, which is like the national party in Mexico, or was, I believe. It's a big party there. And the Oaxaca government is also, or was also, a PRI party, I guess. So they were, involved up to their ears in this situation. It wasn't just a paramilitary group. It was, a state-sponsored paramilitary group. And they decided to carry out a quote-unquote humanitarian mission in San Juan Copla. So what they did is they raided the municipality, and then they left. They decided everything was fine. Also, it turned out that the state police who led the raid were accompanied by a group of 30 members of UBISORT. After the police left, the paramilitaries took control of San Juan Copla. Following this, a significant group of Chiqui women and children set up a camp at the main plaza in Oaxaca City, and that's the camp that continues even now. And the purpose of the camp, apart from seeking refuge from the paramilitaries, which was like the underlying purpose, was to demand justice and accountability for the Chiqui people, and just to start getting justice dealt out here to all the crimes that are being committed against these defenseless peaceful people who are only trying to live their own way of life. About a month after the camp was established, the paramilitaries publicly threatened to massacre anyone that supported the municipality, and this led in just a few short weeks to the Chiqui of San Juan Copla abandoning their traditional lands. So everybody became refugees. The camp continued, however. In fact, the struggle moved, from San Juan Copla to Oaxaca City, and that's where it's continued. Unfortunately, after that abandonment of the traditional territory, the international community basically closed its eye to the struggle. And, situation hasn't been getting very much attention since then. But there have actually been two evictions of the camp, both of which have taken place during the Christmas season. So the most recent eviction was in December of 2012. The government has played all sorts of these vicious games. There have actually been several attempts of the Chiqui to return home since the camp was established, but the government has employed various tactics to prevent that from happening, going so far as to change agreements that took months to establish, and even setting up police blockades to physically prevent the Chiqui from going forward on the road that leads to San Juan Copla. The evictions, though, have been centered around allegedly, at least, making way for oncoming tourists for the Christmas season. That's what it's been on both occasions in 2011 and most recently. Just before the recent eviction, though, the state governor claimed that there was no longer any reason for the camp to continue. And that the government is satisfied that it's obeyed the rule of law. Even though, of course, there's been no justice, and even though the Chiqui people still can't go home. After the recent eviction, as in 2011, the Chiqui reestablished their camp, ignoring everything that the government said, to continue pursuing their demand for justice. It's a very it's a very painful situation, especially for the for the women and children there. You know, the children, well, the basic, you know, like the children are surrounded with constant reminders of everything that's happened to them. You know, they're being raised in this as refugees, you know, apart from their territory, and they're being, you know, taught their way of life in front of the you know, government palace. So it's a tough situation, especially since, you know, nobody's really paying attention internationally. They were at one point, you know, especially during the caravans that were taking place. You know, the mainstream media was actually doing a semi-decent job, which is, you know, impressive to say the least, for considering how little they usually cover of indigenous struggles.
Mm-hmm.
But that's long gone now, you know. But the Chikwi are, you know, continuing to push for their right to return home, for all the paramilitaries to just back off and, you know, just let them live.
Yeah. Now you were talking about. And when I was reading about this, reading up on this last night, and what you were just explaining, like sort of the complex nature of it, that I also understand that there are two rival Chikwi groups, correct? That they're like, and they're kind of also fighting one another as well.
I still haven't actually totally wrapped my head around that, but yeah, there's two groups. There's Ubisort. And then there's Malt and Malt Pop and lots of initials. So there's at least three groups, I'd say, in addition to the traditionals who were, you know, who had declared sovereignty or autonomy. Yeah, but it is really a, you know, a complex situation there.
Yeah, that and like as you said, like. That complexity is just sort of augmented by the fact of, you know, it's tough to get information about all this, of all what's going on there, correct?
Right. It is, yeah.
Yeah. But let's move on here to, I guess, we'll be going to Japan by way of New Zealand, or New Zealand by way of Japan here. There's an interesting exchange program that's happening between two indigenous groups. So talk about that, because I think this this really fascinated me when I was reading up on it last night.
Cool, I actually find it pretty fascinating too, and very encouraging. So it's a exchange program, a cultural exchange program between the Ainu and the Maori people. Now the idea for the exchange came about in January 2012 when a Maori leader visited Tokyo and the traditional land of the Ainu, known as Ainu Masur, to witness the efforts of the Ainu to revitalize their culture, their language, and their rights in Japan. Now, like with many indigenous peoples around the world, the Ainu have been dealing with a long history of colonialism, especially since 1899. It's when the Japanese government passed a new law that labeled the Ainu former indigenous people, and from that point on, it began to take control of Ainu lands, develop infrastructure across their territory. Began forcing the Ainu to learn Japanese language, to abandon their own names in favor of Japanese names, and they also forced them to stop all customary practices, including the tradition of tattooing their faces. That's actually making a comeback now, and that's an important aspect of this, I think. The other thing too is, though, out of the pressure that the Ainu were under from the Japanese government, and out of a deep-seated fear for discrimination, the Ainu started to deny their own identity. And in less than two generations, the Ainu culture essentially vanished, leading most people around the world to just assume that the Ainu, didn't actually exist anymore. But that began to change in the 90s. After years of pressure from Ainu activists, the old assimilation law was replaced with a new quote-unquote Ainu cultural promotion law, you know, didn't include anything about, you know, land or resource rights, but it sent a signal for the restoration of the Ainu way of life. And, you know, the, you know, various activists have been, you know, working on that ever since then, especially especially since the 90s. And that was actually followed up in 2008 with the official recognition of the Ainu as the, you know, indigenous peoples of Japan, which is also a, you know, very significant victory, given the years of discrimination. Unfortunately, that discrimination has been, you know, entrenched pretty deep in the society, to the point where, you know, most Ainu don't acknowledge, still don't acknowledge their identity. According to official government statistics, there's 24,000 Ainu in Japan, when in fact there's more than 200,000. But of that great number, there's only about 100 people who are willing to admit, accept, and live an Ainu way of life. Now, the Ainu Maori exchange is, you know, a prime way for that to change. It's a very strong pathway that's giving the Ainu a lot of resources and knowledge that they didn't necessarily have prior to the exchange happening. And I guess the center of the exchange is around the Ainu learning the strategies of the Maori towards you know, reclaiming, revitalizing their own languages, living in peace and friendship with New Zealand, and even integrating with New Zealand without without compromising, you know, their languages and cultures and practices and customs. And I think that's something that the Ainu envision for themselves with Japan, and that's also the case with many indigenous peoples in northern and southern Asia. You know, to live in peace and friendship and to integrate without compromise. So this exchange program was centered around seven youths who were accompanied by a couple elders and translators to study closely the Maori methods for a 5-week period. And I guess they actually raised the money for the effort on their own using Indiegogo.com, which is you know, one of two good crowdfunding sources that indigenous peoples have been using over the past couple of years. The other one being Kickstarter. They successfully raised just over $11,000 to bring everybody down to Aotearoa to carry out this exchange. I actually think the exchange just ended in late February. So they're still, I think they're still processing everything. I checked out their website this morning, and there hasn't been any updates recently, but I think they got took to school. You know, they were learning a lot. You know, they weren't just they were learning strategies for revitalizing culture, such as using art. They went to a Maori university, which is centered around not just it's not a university that stands in opposition to a New Zealand culture or New Zealand society, mainstream New Zealand society, but European society, whatever. But one that focuses more on the Maori culture and way of life and understanding and the language and perception. And they also talked a bit about decolonization specifically, and coming to terms with the impact that colonization has had on the hearts and minds of the Ainu people. And one point they made here was that they need to identify and dissect unseen colonialism. Not just the straightforward stuff that that you get hit with through discrimination and whatnot, but the aspects of it that rip us apart internally, and that struck a big chord with the Ainu by the looks of it. So it's still going to take some time, I think, before they start putting out information to really outline what they've learned and what they intend to do with this information. But I think it is very significant, not just for the ANU in revitalizing their languages, but it's also a strong example for indigenous peoples around the world who are in the same position as the ANU, or worse or better, wherever everyone is in reestablishing their own languages and cultures, that there's nothing wrong with reaching out to those who might be in a stronger position. And, we don't have to follow, another nation verbatim, but they, offer us lessons that can strengthen ourselves. And all we really have to do to carry that forward is to put in the effort. And that's all the ANU are doing, because they want to survive. They don't want to, disappear or become relics, which is the way it's been for so long for them. So it's an awesome effort.
Right. Now, I thought it was interesting, especially your comment of, they were really schooled by the Maori. And I think it's just worth noting, if you could explain sort of the rights and the stuff that the Maori actually have within New Zealand, which is quite, for an indigenous people, is quite quite rare, right?
Yeah, I actually am pretty lacking in that knowledge. But I get the sense that it's essentially, if not a formal plurinational state, an informal one. Like the Maori culture and New Zealand culture are, interlinked. There's the Maori party, and a lot of the non-Maori people in New Zealand speak the Maori language. So it's really tied together, eh? And that is rare. Like there are in fact a lot of efforts to build that kind of a binational or plurinational relationship, not just in throughout Asia, but in South America as well, especially in South America. Like that's the idea of a plurinational state is commonplace, like in Bolivia, that's talked about frequently, and in Peru as well, and other states.
I think the other thing too, which is neat, is like you said, like the language, the Maori language is recognized as one of the official languages there, right?
I'm sure of it. Yep.
Yeah. It's interesting. I have family in New Zealand, and I went there. And one of my my uncles, who lives there, he's not Maori. He's from he's from one of the South Pacific Islands called Niue. So it is interesting though when you go, especially on the North Island, the kind of mix that you have there, because there is there's a big Asian population of people who've immigrated there from Japan or China or Vietnam or wherever, and then there's the South Pacific, and then you have the white sort of English culture there as well, and it's like a huge mix. Mm-hmm. It's really it's quite neat, and it's interesting how much when I was there, how much a lot of that stuff is embraced, right? How much the Maori that whole it seems like wow. Because I'm not an expert on this, but just from my impression, it's like an actual pluralism is actually really embraced there, more so than I can say about Canada, right?
Oh yeah, by a long shot.
Yeah, by a long shot. Now let's look at this next one. So not going that far away from our discussion on sort of New Zealand and Japan is Australia. So there is a ruling in court that says that a mining company has to negotiate with an indigenous group. So talk about that and who these indigenous people are and what this whole court ruling is about.
Okay, well, the people are the Yindjibarndi people, and they live in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. They've been dealing with a mining company known as Fortescue Metals Group. I believe that's right, yeah, FMG, the company wants to establish a massive iron mine called the Firetail Mine Project in a culturally sensitive area of the Yindjibarndi's traditional lands. And the company has been Well, they've been pretty vicious in their political strategy to undermine the Indrabarji people, destroy their sacred sites, remove burial grounds, and carry forward with the mine project without benefiting the community or, you know, defending their culture, way of life, and, you know, just bypassing their rights altogether. This is unfortunately a pretty common strategy of mining companies and several companies in particular in the Western Australia region. One pretty serious thing that the company has done, which this recent court ruling is centered on, was the establishment of a false representative body known as the Wilru Mura Yindjibarndi Aboriginal Corporation, WMYAC, their initials. Before I go any further, I should point out that most Indigenous peoples in society in Australia these days are representative not by tribal councils or band councils like in Canada and elsewhere, but they're actually represented by corporations, which is similar to the model that was forced on Indigenous peoples in Alaska. But the actual representative body of the Yindjibarndi is the Yindjibarndi Aboriginal Corporation, or YAC. Now, the WMYAC came about after the Fortescue came onto the scene. Now, the YAC said all along, this is a fake representative body, you know, this doesn't represent us, it's made of community members, but this isn't the real representatives of the people. And, you know, FMG is funding this group, and they're using them to undermine the Yindjibarndi culture and so on. And FMG was always like, oh, no, you know, we're not doing anything wrong, and these are the real ones, and we're going to work with them, and they want to work with us, and, you know, we're not doing anything wrong, and so on. The company also, you know, destroyed a number of Yindjibarndi sites. I believe they also split in half a sacred rock. They may have also moved burial remains, and they also downplayed the number of heritage sites, you know, in the mining zone. Obviously, in an effort to, move forward their project that much further. The list goes on with FMG. They've just been playing all these games. Fortunately, there was one bit of important thing. One important thing happened before this recent court ruling was that the head of the WMYAC became a whistleblower, and he publicly stated that yes, the WMYAC was created to help Fortescue Metals, and they were funded by them. That's a very important detail, and it was a big victory, in fact, for the Yindjibarndi peoples. You know, it vindicated them, and it also exposed FMG's game, which has been, you know, I guess it's been known by everybody, but, you know, that, you know, affirmed it once and for all. And then came the court ruling, which, let me see my notes here. I didn't write that down. Well, the court ruled ultimately that the company has to negotiate with the Yindjibarndi people, and it can only negotiate with the YAC, the true representative body of the Yindjibarndi. So, which is, you know, actually a very important ruling because, you know, now the WMYAC is totally out of the picture, and that's been a pretty significant burden on the Yindjibarndi struggle. It's always been, you know, a constant fight between these two groups, you know, and it was just causing, you know, a divide between the community, which is, of course, you know, embraced by the mining company. So now that group is out of the picture now. But the formal representatives of the Yindjibarndi aren't, you know, holding any animosity towards the members of the WMYAC. You know, they've told them, you know, we can just let that go, you know, no harm done, you can come home, you know, we can move forward. But the ruling also, you know, it's a big point of justice for the Yindjibarndi people. It almost guarantees that the project isn't going to go ahead, I would say, providing, of course, the government, the Western Australia government, doesn't enact their infamous law that allows them to give the company the right to destroy Indigenous lands and sacred sites because of the investment opportunities that it offers or whatever. Some such nonsense. One thing, though, that's worth noting, too, is that the company's CEO, Nev Power, is continuing to claim that they're not doing anything wrong and that they only want, quote-unquote, the best for the injured Barney peoples. He also recently stated that the company's 10-year applications for the mine project are supported by the National Native Title Tribunal, which was more of a message to the shareholders because the company's feeling pretty scared right about now. The thing about that, though, is that the National Native Title Tribunal has just launched an inquiry into undeclared conflicts of interests involving one of the company's former CEOs, former executives, whose partner worked for the WMYAC, which is big, another dropkick against FMG. It's as if everything that the company's been throwing forward, quote unquote, with the best intentions for the injured Barney, has been coming back at them, and the company, being quite inept, is getting hit in the face again and again and again. And hopefully that keeps happening. I'm shedding no tears for this company. They've been just so manipulative and underhanded with their strategy. It's preposterous. So, hopefully their project goes down.
Well, well, thank you, John, for coming on and talking about these three very interesting, Indigenous issues and struggles going around the world. And also, as always, every time I have you on, I'm always taken aback by sort of the wide berth of Indigenous struggles and issues around the world that, as you kind of had mentioned in the interview, that doesn't get much attention at all. So it's always great to have you on.
For sure. I'm happy to present this to everybody, and I'm honored to return again and again to your show.
Yeah, no, it's a great thing.
And we are back. That was my interview with John Shurto of Intercontinental Cry, talking about Indigenous struggles around the world. So that was, it's always great to talk to John. And like I said, if you check out intercontinentalcry.org and you look at the kind of information resource that he does basically on his own, after the interview, we kind of talked a bit. And so there is some exciting things happening for Intercontinental Cry, but go check it out. Really interesting news, interesting stuff happening there that I don't think gets talked about enough, or if at all, in other media sources. And, like I said, he's a good testimony to, it's not easy, but of what independent media can actually do for you and the kind of information that we can have. Anyways, we're going to go for a quick musical break. I figured what I'm going to play is a bit of music from a group called A Tribe Called Red, which got quite a bit of attention. They sort of mix Indigenous powwow music and Indigenous music with kind of electronic music. They also wrote a song that was dedicated to Idle No More. We're going to hear a song off of their, I guess this is their debut, or at least what we have at the station. This song is called Electric Powwow Drum, and we will be back in a moment. This is Warning Shots on CKUW 95.9 FM. Yes, and we are back. That was a bit of music from Tribe called Red. Very interesting stuff. So that was the show for today for Warning Shots for March the 8th. Let's get this theme going here. There we are. All right. So that was the show for today. You heard an interview with John Chertow, manager, editor, creator of Intercontinental Cry, talking about some indigenous struggles and issues happening in Mexico, in Australia, as well as an indigenous cultural exchange between indigenous groups and the Maori and the Anu, the Maori in New Zealand and the Anu in Japan. Very interesting. And as always, it's great to have John on. So that was the show. And then, of course, you had your news and brief, and you just heard a track from A Tribe Called Red. And that was the show. So now, as far as the next couple of weeks, I think hopefully the next 2 weeks we'll have some coverage and talking about Ethiopia, the political situation there, what's sort of going on. Hopefully have some coverage of that as well. As I've mentioned before on the show, something I've been following and kind of doing more research on, I have some contacts and stuff I'm going to start putting together. There are these programs in southern Ethiopia that are supposed to be voluntary for villagization of semi-nomadic peoples. And they're basically being forced off their land. There's reports of abuse, murder. So we'll be talking about all that. So hopefully in the next couple weeks, a bit on Ethiopia and what's going on in that country. And then after that, I'm not sure at this point, but for sure the next 2 weeks, I'm in my mind, I'm trying to put something together for on Ethiopia. So tune in the next couple weeks to hear about the situation there and what's going on in Ethiopia. Now, questions, comments, concerns, couple ways you can do that. You can phone the office, 204-786-9782. Contact our news director, Michael Welsh, at ckwnews@rocketmail.com. Contact me, warningshots.ckuw959@gmail.com. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Warning Shots. Follow the radio station at CKUW on Twitter to keep tabs of what's going on here. Now, as far as that would be it. So again, happy International Women's Day. Have a safe and fun weekend, and I will talk to you all next week with hopefully some news on what's going on in Ethiopia. So until then, stay safe out there, be kind to one another, and I hope to talk to you all again next week. Bye-bye, this is Scott Price, signing off. Coming up next, though, is the Community Cupboard as well. The guys from Mercy of Slumber should be in, as well there's Now Sounds and Peg City Groove, so keep it locked here on CKW 95.9 FM.
Grab yourself a pen and some paper. It's time for CKW's Community Cupboard. Announcements and resources from and in your community. If you have a public service announcement or community resource to share, contact us at 786-9782 or email ckuw@uwinnipeg.ca.
Yeah, here is your Community Cupboard. Okay, so the Rupert's Land Caregiver Services has an announcement here. Start something new this spring. The Rupert's Land Caregiver Services Ring a Ride program needs volunteer drivers to take clients residing in southwest Winnipeg to appointments, shopping, and social outings. Compensation for gas and parking is provided. Volunteers can be available as little or as much as they wish. Even once per month helps. For more information about this opportunity, please call 204-452-9491. That's 204-452-9491. Light launches a Give Change to Make Change campaign. This is an effort to raise funds for their community economic development or seed grant programs. So Light hopes to raise $4,000 through the initiative, and they want through all of your pennies, actually. So they want all your unwanted coins, essentially. Donations are being accepted at the Light office at 786 Main Street throughout the months of February and March. Alternatively, pickups can be arranged. For more information, call Sarah, the development coordinator at Light, at 204-942-8578 to get to give your pennies for an unwanted change for a good program. Ah, yes, and the Butterfly Club is set up by Kana Nichek. This is an after-school program for girls aged 9 to 13, starting now until June every Wednesday evening from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at 455 McDermott Avenue. Activities include crafts, sports, games, outings, cultural teachings, and ceremonies. For more information, you can call Chrissy, 204-953-5820. And one final one, also from Kana Nichek, empowering their our little sisters. 2013. This program offers Aboriginal mothers and caregivers and daughters the opportunity to make powwow regalia and learn cultural teachings in a caring and supportive environment. So to register, contact Chantel at Kana Nichek. The phone number is 204-953-5820, extension 225. So that's